This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tom McKee. The White House says that U.S. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden will travel to Surfside, Florida on Thursday to visit with families of the victims of the collapsed Miami-area condominium tower. The slow work of sifting through the remnants of the collapsed building, stretched into a six-day Tuesday, now moves into a seventh day this Wednesday, as families are desperate for progress, endured a wrenching wait for answers. Biden has offered federal help and extended his concerns to the community. The number of confirmed dead now stands at 12, with 150 people still unaccounted for after last Thursday's collapse. Israel's new foreign minister is in the United Arab Emirates on the first high-level trip by an Israeli official to the Gulf Arab state since the two countries normalized relations last year. Yair Lapid's visit Tuesday to the UAE capital of Abu Dhabi comes after the two countries formalized ties in a deal brokered by the Trump administration. Lapid, the architect of a new Israeli government that brought down the record 12-year-long tenure of Benjamin Netanyahu, inaugurated the Israeli embassy in Abu Dhabi. At that event, he called on countries of the region to recognize that Israel's here to stay. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says that the grave incident has threatened his country's coronavirus prevention efforts. It's a rare admission by Pyongyang. During a meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, Kim chastised senior officials for unspecified carelessness related to the coronavirus pandemic. The news agency said that officials have caused a grave incident that poses a huge crisis to the safety of the nation and its people. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Indonesia's COVID-19 surge is on the edge of a catastrophe as the more infections of the Delta variant dominates transmission and chokes hospitals in Southeast Asia's worst epidemic. That's according to the Red Cross on Tuesday. Indonesia has reported record daily COVID-19 infections of more than 20,000 in recent days, and a new wave of infections fueled by the emergence of highly transmissible virus variants and increased mobility after the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. Hospitals in several designated red zone areas have reported overcapacity, including the capital, Jakarta, with its isolation beds 93% occupied as of Sunday. A nurse working in a state-run hospital in North Jakarta said that there were COVID patients who died while waiting for a hospital bed. U.S. officials are closing four emergency facilities set up to house record numbers of migrant children caught crossing the Mexican border alone. But officials Tuesday cautioned that minors are still arriving on the southern border despite the summer heat. The Department of Health and Human Services will shut two facilities in Texas and two at convention centers in California by early August. The juvenile coordinator for the agency's Office of Refugee Resettlement says four sites will remain open, including one that faced criticism from immigrant advocates at Fort Bliss Army Base in El Paso, Texas. U.S. officials have reported a recent drop in the number of immigrant children held in emergency facilities. For China's Communist Party, celebrating its 100th birthday on Thursday, it's not just about glorifying its past, it's also about cementing its future and that of its leader, Chinese President Xi Jinping. In the build-up to the July 1st anniversary, Xi and the party have exhorted its members and nation to remember the early days of the struggle. Experts say the party has long invoked its history to justify its right to rule. Shoring up its legitimacy is critical since the party has run China single-handedly for more than 70 years. Recapping one of our top stories, Israel's new foreign minister was in the United Arab Emirates on a first high-level trip by an Israeli official to the Gulf Arab state since the two countries normalized relations last year. Yair Lapid's visit Tuesday to the UAE comes after two countries formalized ties in a deal brokered by the Trump administration. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June the 30th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Despite the Ethiopian government's declaration of a unilateral ceasefire in the Tigray region, rebels in the embattled region are warning that their troops would seek to destroy the capabilities of Ethiopian and Eritrean forces. Meanwhile, the UN says that the impact of the ceasefire on humanitarian activities is still unknown.
The consequences and impact of the immediate ceasefire remain unclear. Our humanitarian colleagues tell us there's been a breakdown in telecommunications and internet services in Tigray as of today.
That is UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric. Meanwhile, the U.S. government says that Ethiopia and Eritrea should anticipate further actions if the announced cessation of hostilities does not lead to improvements in the Tigray region. Also, many questions still remain on the situation in Tigray. And now that the federal government has declared a ceasefire, does that mean that the fighting is completely over?
In Tigray itself, there are still areas where the federal government forces are in control, and the Tigrayan forces have said that they want to remove them.
Ali Vergi is a researcher for the United States Institute of Peace, and Tanzania has, for the first time in more than a year, released figures on the coronavirus in the country, confirming 100 cases since a third wave of infections began. We have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa, so stay tuned. And for our top story, we go to the Horn of Africa. Despite the declaration of a unilateral ceasefire in Ethiopia's Tigray region, rebels of the Tigray Defense Forces are warning that their troops would seek to destroy the capabilities of Ethiopian and Eritrean forces. A spokesman for the Tigrayan forces battling Ethiopia's government warned Tuesday in an interview with Reuters that his forces would enter neighboring Eritrea and Ethiopia's Amhara region to, quote, pursue enemy forces if necessary. The Ethiopian government announced a ceasefire on state media late Monday, saying that it would take effect immediately. But thousands in the region affected by the eight-month war are still unable to gain access to humanitarian aid. The UN says that the impact of the ceasefire remains unclear.
The consequences and impact of the immediate ceasefire remain unclear. Our humanitarian colleagues tell us there's been a breakdown in telecommunications and internet services in Tigray as of today. So the impact of the current situation on the humanitarian operations remain unknown at this moment.
That is UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric. He says that the UN aid agencies are ready to resume full operations after a security assessment of the conditions on the ground.
Humanitarian operations have been constrained in the past few days due to the ongoing fighting. We're ready to resume full operations pending security and access assessment as to the new conditions on the ground. We, along with our partners, are looking at options to scale up the humanitarian relief operations in light of what we find following the assessment. We're also looking at supply routes into Tigray in consultations with our security colleagues and logistics experts.
Meanwhile, the U.S. government says that Ethiopia and Eritrea should anticipate further actions if the announced cessation of hostilities does not lead to improvements in the Tigray region.
If the government's announcement of a cessation of hostilities does not result in improvements and the situation continues to worsen, Ethiopia and Eritrea should anticipate further actions. We will not stand by in the face of horrors in Tigray. At the same time, we continue to emphasize to the governments of Addis Ababa and Asmara that another path is possible. We stand ready to work with them in ending the humanitarian suffering, resolving the conflict, and renewing momentum towards economic and political reforms. We urge them to make the right choices for the people of Ethiopia.
That is Ambassador Robert Godek, the Acting Assistant Secretary of State for the State Department's Bureau of African Affairs. He was speaking at a House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing. Ambassador Godec said that the Biden administration was far advanced in its assessment of whether to call events crimes against humanity, genocide, or war crimes.
We will watch closely to determine if the ceasefire results in changes on the ground. But the Ethiopian government's decision to declare a temporary end to hostilities is a promising development, and we welcome it. It is essential now that all parties commit to the ceasefire, allow humanitarian access, protect civilians, there be independent investigations into atrocities, and that there is justice for victims. Ethiopia is at a pivot point, at an inflection point. What the parties do now matters and will determine whether there is a better future ahead for Ethiopia.
That was Ambassador Robert Godec speaking at the House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing at the U.S. Congress. The chairperson of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki Mahamat, has welcomed the declaration of the ceasefire in the Tigray region. He called it a right step towards the resolution of the conflict. And now some regional experts say that the news that Ethiopian federal forces are withdrawing from Mekele, the capital of the Tigray region, and that the federal government has declared a ceasefire does not necessarily mean that the fighting is completely over. Ali Vergi, who is based in London, is a researcher for the United States Institute of Peace, specializing in East Africa. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson a short time ago about the implications of the ceasefire.
There are two contrary narratives. One is that the ferocity of the Tigrayan forces' actions has prompted the federal government to resort to a ceasefire. The second is that the federal government had been planning this, recognizing the humanitarian situation is deteriorating and something needed to be done. I think the truth is probably a combination of the two, but it's worth noting that only a week ago, the federal government was still conducting air raids, and so it does seem that the military might of the Tigrayan opposition has precipitated the exact date of this announcement, if not necessarily that it was coming.
Now, is it likely to help bring some degree of peace and stability to Ethiopia, particularly in the Tigray region?
In Tigray itself, there are still areas where the federal government forces are in control, and the Tigrayan forces have said that they want to remove them, and so we could still anticipate that there may be fighting to come in some parts of Tigray. Clearly in areas where the federal government's forces have withdawn entirely, there is a prospect that there will be less fighting. We still don't know what will happen with the allied forces, both from the Amhara region that have been in Tigray, as well as the Eritrean forces, is what their intentions are. But elsewhere in Ethiopia, this will have very little effect on the security situation there, and the country remains consumed by many challenges, by many security issues in other parts of the country as well.
Now, finally, sir, are there any regional implications for other countries surrounding the Horn, Sudan, Somalia, Eritrea?
Clearly, the Eritrean forces have been pivotal in this conflict, and we don't yet know whether the forces will remain. The Ethiopian government has said several times that they will be withdrawn. We haven't yet seen evidence of that. It's clear that the Eritrean government has no love lost for the Tigrayan forces, and so it'll be a very difficult pill for them to swallow to accept that they remain or have retained control or regain control. And elsewhere, it seems possible that part of what has accounted for the resurgence of the Tigrayan forces has been support from Sudan, or at least some material crossing that border. It's difficult to be sure of that, but it does seem that there is also a clear interest for the Sudanese government, or at least part of the Sudanese government, to support forces that are opposed to the government of Abiy Ahmed. So there are clearly regional implications to this, and the humanitarian implications are also regional as well. Just because the fighting has stopped doesn't solve the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are in need of assistance, are facing hunger, and will continue to face that challenge, and may be forced to either continue to move into other parts of the country or indeed across borders.
That was Ali Verje, a researcher for the United States Institute of Peace, specializing in East Africa. He was speaking to VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. And for the first time in more than a year, Tanzania has released figures on coronavirus, confirming 100 cases since a third wave of infections began. President Samia Hassan says Tanzania has budgeted $470 million to buy COVID-19 vaccines. The actions mark a sharp turn from Hassan's predecessor, the late John Magufuli. Charles Kombe reports.
A week ago, Tanzania's health ministry warned citizens that a third wave of COVID-19 infection was spreading across Africa. On Monday, President Samia Hassan announced Tanzania has recorded 100 such cases in recent days and said 70 patients required oxygen. She warned citizens to protect themselves from infection.
Sasa, ukiangalia si wengi.
Hassan said when you look at the number of patients, it's not that high, but we must protect ourselves so it doesn't rise. She said the first step her government has taken is to go in line with the world by allowing the vaccine. And it will be voluntarily, she said. Hassan emphasized that a citizen who wants to be vaccinated will get the shot, and those who didn't want it will not be disturbed until they change their minds. Hassan said $470 million have been budgeted to purchase COVID-19 vaccine and provide economic relief for businesses that were severely hit by the pandemic. In a message on Twitter, U.S. Ambassador to Tanzania, Donald Wright, welcomed Hassan's intent to buy vaccine and signaled that the U.S. is ready to help. Now, are the country's healthcare services ready to deal with COVID-19? Shadrack Mwaibambe is the president of the Tanzania Medical Association. He says we have taken lessons from the first and second waves of COVID-19. The country is standing firm, and where there are weaknesses, we are continuing to address them, he says. Mwaibambe says that is why the president has decided to handle the pandemic using scientific methods like accepting its presence, and she's fighting it. The amount of money that is set is enough, and she has not diverted it to other areas, he says. Rights activists say, with the government now doing its part, citizens should also follow COVID-19 guidelines. Felista Mawia is the Director of Empowerment and Accountability with the Legal and Human Rights Center. We continue to emphasize that citizens and the whole society should continue to observe precautions by washing hands, wearing masks, and observing social distancing, she says. Mawia added that people should focus on the guidelines and statements that our leaders are issuing, following all the health guidelines, and we can fight the virus. President Hassan has yet to announce when the vaccine will arrive, but said Tanzania has joined the COVAX facility that sends doses to lower-income countries. She said specialists are determining which brand of vaccine will be sent to Tanzania and how it will be distributed. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
In Nigeria, video has surfaced showing Boko Haram militants pledging loyalty to the Islamic State West African province, also known as ISWAP. It comes just weeks after Boko Haram's leader was reported killed in a battle with ISWAP. Nigerian security experts say the video shows that ISWAP could be consolidating control of the country's terrorist insurgency. For more on this, Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The 13-minute-long video shows fighters from both factions chanting in solidarity. Soon afterward, the Boko Haram fighters pledge their support for the newly appointed ISWAP commander known as Khalifa Muslimai, meaning the leader of all Muslims. A Nigerian military spokesperson was not immediately available to comment, but security expert Senator Irebu says a fusion of both groups could mean more lethal attacks.
They have now ability to concentrate their energy. There will be consolidation of leadership, consolidation of resources, consolidation of intelligence, which will be even more difficult for Nigerian states to deal with, because when they have two factions, we could easily infiltrate an ability to work one against the other.
Boko Haram and ISWAP have been clashing for control of territory for many years. Boko Haram is known to hold larger bases in northeastern Nigeria's Borno and Adamawa states. In May, the group's leader, Abubakar Shekau, reportedly blew up himself in order to avoid capture by ISWAP, although it must be noted that Shekau has been reported dead many times before. Darlington Abdullahi, a retired high-ranking Air Force officer, says ISWAP will likely take control of more areas, but says the rivalry between the groups is not over.
They are tested, more tested, because they are coming from an environment, they've been at war, even with the very strong nations. So the battle between the two groups will actually still continue for some time. But on the whole, it feels that there's more danger for the livelihood, the lives of people around generally.
Abdullahi says government security forces must act without delay or there will be repercussions.
At this stage is when all elements, all force should be brought against them, because they are still trying to find their footing and try to get other elements of Boko Haram into their fold.
ISWAP is known for often targeting the military and easily recruiting civilians from communities. Experts fear that ISWAP's reign will make the Islamist insurgency much more difficult to control and set back years of progress. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
A new report shows that Africa's online sector could grow if women running online businesses got more training and support. Mohammed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi.
A global development organization says women run more online businesses in Africa, but face greater challenges than online firms led by men. The International Financial Corporation, which is the arm of the World Bank that helps the private sector, and Jumia, the largest online business platform in Africa, say in a new report that the pandemic has hurt sales for women's online businesses by 39%. In comparison, male-led businesses saw sales drop only 28%. Charlotte and team analyzes disruptive technologies for the IFC's Gender and Economic Inclusion Group. She says there are more women in high-competition fields like beauty products, where it is hard for individuals to distinguish themselves.
When you think of selling, for example, in beauty, just beyond the high levels of competition, if you think about the pandemic and the closures of borders, having to get products in perhaps from different parts of the world to sell online, that presents a whole other challenge. So I think a lot of the challenges are impacted by the spaces in which we find women.
Jumia, Checker, 6060, Conga and Kilimall platforms have made Africa's online shopping flourish. The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, says African online shopping has increased by 18% since 2014, compared to a 12% increase globally. But the COVID-19 pandemic hit women's businesses especially hard. The World Bank and Facebook Data for Good survey released in June 2020 found that 43% of female-owned firms were temporarily closed, compared to 34% of male-owned businesses. In South Africa, 52% of female-owned businesses closed. In Nigeria, the number was 44%. In Ghana, 37%. Intim says digital and financial gaps continue to hold business women back.
There is a huge financing gap globally. It's about $1 trillion. And you think about the fact as well that regardless of where you are in the world, women do use the internet less than men. And that is fundamentally related to the cost of access. Sometimes, depending on where they are in the world, there are social norms that prevent their use or ownership of even mobile phones for use of different purposes.
Washo Mureidi sells hair products online. She has been in the business for 4 years, but she struggled to understand the online behavior of Kenyan buyers.
The learning curve is very, very, very long. It takes a while to get to understand how things work, actually. So I think, even to be honest, it took me maybe 2 years to figure it out. You know how people keep talking about Google Voice being the future? How people search for things, what they type, that mentality, it's a little bit deeper than what you learn maybe in class about marketing. Online is the other way around. You have to put yourself in their shoes.
The IFC is urging women not to be afraid of taking out loans and other forms of financing to help them operate their businesses. The financial organization is calling on online platforms to provide training for women-led businesses. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And we stay in East Africa, in Uganda, where the country's Minister of Health has started extending vaccination exercises in local communities. They say that with the ongoing lockdown, it is important to take these services to places nearby homes for easy access. But some citizens are still concerned they haven't been sensitized enough. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Dr. Diana Twine, the permanent secretary in Uganda's Ministry of Health, says with limited means of travel brought about by the lockdown, it was important to bring the vaccination for COVID-19 closer to the people.
We have set up specific places. We have put it out on our social media channels. People should be free to check. We made sure that now we have more stations because of lockdown, people cannot move easily, but at least we made sure that we put it nearer where people are residing and people can walk. It is a walkable distance.
With the limited vaccines available, only people coming for the second dose are eligible. In March, Uganda received about 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine, which was donated by the COVAX facility. COVAX is a global pool which ensures equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines. Last week, Uganda received some 75,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine donated by the French government. The government has prioritized vaccines for those at high risk, including health workers, teachers, security personnel, and those with chronic diseases. Kampala resident Wenceslas Arihampera is among the few who took the second dose this Monday, but he says he's still not conversant with the vaccine. He's calling on the government to provide more information about the vaccine to dispel the myth surrounding taking the jab.
The government should sensitize the community, because the community people or the people will go on their will. They will go willingly. They will say, let me go there on my wish. And the person will go knowing that I am going to save my life. But in case of any problem, I will swallow what will come out.
Fitness coach Andrew Olupot agrees.
Word has to be spread more to the people on how the vaccine works, because there are very many contradictory statements, people getting vaccinated and still they are dying, or people getting vaccinated and still they get COVID. So I think the Ministry of Health should come out and extend the education, the sensitization to people.
Uganda has been hit with the second wave of COVID-19, and officials are worried the new variants are more lethal. About 300 people have been confirmed to have died with the deadly COVID-19 in just the two past weeks alone. Officials aim to vaccinate at least 10 million Ugandans in an effort to fight the disease. For VOA News, I am Gume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good week ahead, Africa.